In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened.
We are a nation generated by ideas, the beneficiaries of people who took terrific risks and who were a fount, if you will, of originality and ingenuity.
So if people have views that you find offensive, we can either silence them so that nobody challenges us for 4 years, or we can welcome them, debate with them, and try to hash it out and make us all smarter.
So we're back to our Beyond Brutality series, and, you know, in all honesty, I thought it was the police brutality or the police interrogation or something like that that was going to make me want to break the no swearing rule, but it's this. It's prosecutors. Man, I have a lot of feelings, and all of them rhyme with the word cluck, or at least they have a word that rhymes with the word clucking bell. It is so bad. And, you know, the entire point of this series of discussions is to talk about areas of our legal system where we need to see reform. And, you know, it's not the sexy stuff. It's not the stuff that makes good headlines. You know, we all agree, and it seems like an easy fix to say the cops shouldn't shoot people in the street. But that's not where it stops. And, you know, we talked about qualified immunity with cops, but you want to talk about everything wrong with cops being wrong, but also on crystal meth? You have that with prosecutors, especially like the discretion and the power they wield and the way they can choose to carry out cases. It's just, it is FUBAR. It is such a FUBAR situation. So I'm not going to ask Austin what he's drinking. I'm just going to start by saying I'm drinking scotch. I'm drinking Old Pulteney Highland Scotch, because I need to drink something nice or I'm just going to break the no swearing rule within the first 5 minutes.
I just finished the old fashioned I was drinking for the recording of the last episode, so I'm good. Let's go.
Let's go. All right. So prosecutors, obviously, we, you know, at the point we are at, quote unquote, we've talked about the cops. We've talked about Miranda rights. We've talked about Fourth Amendment rights. We've talked about interrogations. But it's the prosecutor who takes things over from here, right? And prosecutors are just, I don't want to say that every prosecutor is a psychopath, because I don't like broad generalizations, but I really think if somebody chooses to be a prosecutor and chooses to stay in that for their career, I would question their morality, if not their sanity. Like, the things that prosecutors are not only allowed to do, but actively incentivized to do. I mean, for starters, to be a prosecutor, your job is not to achieve justice. Your job is not to even seek justice. Your job is to get a conviction by any means possible.
That isn't the legal standard. And that's part of the problem, is that legally, prosecutors are supposed to seek to convict only the guilty and recognize cases where they shouldn't seek a conviction and, you know, behave accordingly. That's what prosecutorial discretion is supposed to mean. Based on my limited knowledge, and this is actually an area where you're going to know more than me, based on my limited knowledge, there is a culture that demands the opposite, that just says you need to get convictions. And we'll get into it, I'm sure, but there's a lot that factors into that. You know, prosecutors are elected at the state level, at least in all the states that I'm familiar with. And in order for a prosecutor to get elected, they almost always tend to run on this kind of law and order platform. And then they feel they have to deliver. And in many cases, it's the number of convictions you get that makes you look good and makes you eligible for re-election. I think that's a terrible, just an absolutely awful criteria. There's also the demand of the populace. A lot of people don't understand how criminal justice works and don't do what we say to do, which is, when you're thinking about criminal justice, put yourself in the shoes of an innocent defendant. And so they demand this law and order stuff, so that becomes a vicious circle. I mean, there are prosecutors who I know, at least a little bit, who I respect, and there are prosecutors who will work with you and do the right thing. But at this point, I'm inclined to say that they're kind of like the good cops. They're far too few and far between, and it takes an individual with a remarkable moral fortitude and willingness to go against the grain and take some flack for it to do that. I think that the system is set up to make them into something else, and the people who resist that just happen to be very in the positive sense, stubborn individuals, and that the average person cannot function in that system and not become the problem that we're about to talk about.
Yeah, that's probably a fairer way to put it.
It does help that I work with these people. Like, I'm not just sitting here doing the research. You know, I just on Tuesday had to go and do a case call and work with a prosecutor on that. And it went fine and was actually, you know, prosecutor's fairly lenient with a client who my firm is actually were fed up with this defendant. And the prosecutor is still being very agreeable and maintaining a very generous bargain, even though the guy doesn't deserve it. So there are exceptions out there. And again, I want to state for the record that I don't practice primarily criminal defense. I'm only just now getting into criminal defense, and it's a very low level. I to really drive the point home of where I'm at and how much people should weigh my opinion, I have not handled it, unless I'm forgetting something. I have not handled any felony cases as an attorney. I was involved in some before I was licensed, but since being licensed the past year, I have not handled anything more serious than, I think, one aggravated misdemeanor under Iowa law, mostly just serious and simple misdemeanors.
I mean, for me, and as you rightly point out, you know, you work with these people. I don't. And when I encounter this, it tends to be the worst of the worst, because that's what takes the attention of a psychologist. And that's just what we deal with. I mean, that's just kind of been the history of psychology, is, hey, something's really, really, you know, effed up. Can you poke it with a stick? The book I'm going to recommend, and where a lot of what I'm going to say is kind of rooted in, is called Blind Injustice by Mark Godsey. I think I've recommended this before. He is a former prosecutor, and he was a prosecutor for years, and then he became one of the biggest advocates for defendants in America. He is co-founder of the Innocence Project, in fact, or at least I think the Ohio Innocence Project. I'm not sure where he ranks nationally, but he's very important in the criminal justice reform activism community. So that being said, yes, there is a culture that absolutely incentivizes getting as many convictions as you can, and I think that's kind of the big problem. And I think the two biggest ways it manifests is in prosecutorial immunity and in the specific prosecutorial tactic of plea bargaining. And I'll also say I know a few different prosecutors. I'm not just, you know, buying into the intelligentsia's view. I'm both reading the research, reading people's personal accounts, and reviewing my own personal accounts. And I think the most telling interaction I've had is when I brought up some of these issues that we're about to talk about with a prosecutor. And he kind of laughed at me. He called me a liberal, which I'm like, okay, that's not an insult, but thank you. And he's like, you're such a bleeding heart. You know, imagine what we'd have to do our jobs if we didn't use these tactics. And if these things were made illegal, the criminal justice system would fall. And I'm here like, good, it should. Absolutely. If this is what it requires to have this so-called justice system, it absolutely should. So we'll just get into it and you'll see why I say that. So first off, there's the idea of prosecutorial immunity. And I'm going to have a quote here from Frederick Block. He's a New York City federal trial judge. This will give you some idea of what prosecutors legally can get away with. According to Taylor versus Kavanaugh, a Supreme Court law case, quote, the falsification of evidence and the coercion of witnesses have been held to be prosecutorial activities for which absolute immunity applies. Similarly, because a prosecutor is acting as an advocate in the judicial proceeding, the solicitation and subornation of perjured testimony, the withholding of evidence, or the introduction of illegally seized evidence at trial does not create liability and damages, end quote. So basically, you have this situation where the goal is get as many convictions as you can, you know, be that law and order candidate. And now you have this second ingredient of this crap sandwich being, oh yeah, by the way, anything you do, you can't be held liable.
Yeah, and let's clarify what that means. You can't be sued. It's basically like, you know, it's absolute immunity as compared to, for example, qualified immunity. The defendant can't sue based on that after the fact. It's important to keep in mind that those things do result in reversal on appeal. The conviction won't stand if the court finds that one of those egregious things has happened. The problem, and I think I can kind of put this the way that you were going to go and kind of say why that's still an issue, is they can go ahead and do that and roll the dice. And if the defendant can't or won't appeal, then they get away with it. And there's nothing the defendant can do after the fact, especially when, you know, you've got to make your appeal decision. And normally the standard is 30 days. You can't let that 30 days go by, regret it, and then within your, you know, say 2 to 5 year statute of limitations for civil actions, sue the prosecutor for what they did to ruin your life. The prosecutor basically gets to function with this mentality of, I can get the conviction, and if I have to do some shady things to get the conviction, as long as the guy doesn't have the resources to appeal, then I'm going to be golden. And by resources to appeal, that means one of two things. Either you have someone who qualifies for appellate-appointed counsel, in which case you have a limited number of those people to go around and they have limited hours to devote to each client, or someone has to be able to pay for an appeal after they already paid for a trial, because we're talking about mostly evidentiary and testimonial issues. People just don't have those resources. If you're a middle-class American, let's really drive the point home. This is, again, put yourself in the shoes of this person. If you're a middle-class American, you can't afford a felony criminal trial. And you certainly can't afford a felony criminal trial and then an appeal of that trial with assets you have on hand. You're going to have to, I mean, maybe you'll be able to afford it if you own your house, because you'd be able to take out a mortgage on your house or two and be able to pay for it. But you don't have cash in the bank to pay for this. You just don't. So that's what prosecutors get to bank on, basically, and how they get to make their decisions.
Well, yeah, so you have two problems there, right? So you have the first thing being they're banking on you not being able to defend yourself. And then they also know they're not going to be held civilly or criminally liable.
The worst thing that happens to them is they lose the conviction. That is the exactly. worst possible thing that can happen to them.
And I really like that you brought up that, you know, oh, it's only if you have the money to fight an appeal that they'll be held civilly liable. Or rather, not them personally, but the government may be held civilly liable. So far, just looking at New York alone, New York has paid out over $400 million, depending on who you ask. Some people say it's between $300 and $400 million, in wrongful incarceration suits. These are just the people who got their appeals through, and this is just for prosecutorial misconduct. And then you bring up the cases like Juan Rivera, where the prosecutorial discretion or indiscretion, whatever the hell you want to call it, meant that the fact that there was clear exculpatory evidence, the prosecutor didn't give a flying crap, did not care, lied, creatively misrepresented the truth, whereas if this were anything but lawyers dealing with, we would call it a lie, but these are lawyers, and I swear you're the only human lawyer I know.
Thank you.
it's just misrepresenting the truth, and Juan Rivera loses how many years of his life, and then the state has to pay out $60 million on his fourth trial. Another case really worth looking into is the case of Russell Faria. Dateline did an entire podcast on this that's really – it's worth your time. But long story short, they convicted a man for murder. The real murderer was their star witness who got this guy who accused this guy of murder. And the prosecutor actively, openly, and knowingly lied during their closing statement, and they didn't care because the point wasn't to see justice. It was to get a conviction. And we're already seeing $300 to $400 million payout. That's just the people who can afford to challenge these things. Seeing how widespread this corruption is, we have no idea how many people there are who are being screwed over and languishing in prison because of prosecutorial active misconduct.
I'll actually just do a brief anecdote from my area. This is a Southern District of Iowa case that I read the opinion for. Iowa City, Johnson County prosecutors, I'll be as brief as possible about the facts, but a prosecutor at the Johnson County office was going into Hy-Vee to buy groceries, which is something that at least normal human beings do, and I guess prosecutors do it too, and saw someone who all he could say about this person is he recognized the individual from a case. The individual is black and has a heavy object in the front pocket of his coat. The prosecutor decided this looks like a gun, and based only on the knowledge that it looks like this guy has a gun and I recognize him from a case, calls cops who he personally knows and has them come and find a way to search and detain this individual. Another issue police misconduct. This involves some completely bogus jaywalking accusations as the reason for their initial stop, which the judge correctly and scathingly identified as walking while black. But this prosecutor made this decision based only on recognizing this guy from a case. He didn't know if he was a defendant. He didn't know if he was a defendant, if he had been convicted, if he had been convicted of a felony. He didn't know if he was a witness or a victim. He just knew he recognized him from a case. Background information, carrying weapons concealed in Iowa is legal if you have a permit. And you're basically going to get the permit as long as you aren't a convicted felon. So this prosecutor had really no knowledge to think that this guy was doing anything illegal. On top of all that, the worst thing that happened is then the entire Johnson County Prosecutor's Office decided that when they were going to prosecute this guy for possession for carrying weapons and for possession as a felon, they didn't disclose who their confidential informant was. This guy got to be the confidential informant on the police report for calling the guy in. And the prosecutor's office never disclosed until they were forced to in federal court that their confidential informant was one of their own prosecutors. That is gross misconduct. This guy should be fired, and he should never hold any legal profession position ever again. Now, to be fair, I don't know if there were disciplinary actions taken within the bar. There should have been, because this guy should lose his license. And a few other prosecutors who decided this was a good idea should be fired. But I'm assuming they won't be, because again, meh, I guess this is okay. Of course, it lets this guy win his case and his conviction's thrown out. But actually, it wasn't a conviction. This is an evidentiary issue. The evidence was thrown out, and so they couldn't convict him. He's lucky he won at that stage. But no one's really held responsible, as far as I know, aside from, okay, well, this guy wasn't convicted. But, you know, we already did the whole thing where we, like, imprisoned him and held him in jail and did the whole bond thing that is a racket. And that's okay. And this prosecutor gets to go and do that again because, presumably, nothing happened to him or her, whoever it was.
Well, that's something actually that Judge Block brings up a lot. And he I won't read the quote, but I'll just summarize. He says that there are three things we need to do to just generally create some level of accountability for prosecutors. The first is getting rid of absolute immunity. They need a qualified immunity, and they need a real qualified immunity, the same way that cops do. You should be able to bring suit against them. It's like, oh, so you knew the DNA exonerated me, but you decided to spin a story that still got me convicted. I should be able to own your home and your car and your dog and any knickknacks in your house to which I take a fancy. Like, everything you own is now mine. That is the level that we should be dealing with. And then we might have a few less Juan Rivera cases. But right now it's like, well, I just needed to get my conviction. Surely you can't blame me for that. Yes, I can. You're not a real human being. Second thing that Judge Block suggests is actually, and this is what you're talking about, is losing license. Actually taking steps by legal establishment to punish these people, like suspending their license. This happens occasionally, and you know, he actually brings up a case in Indiana. The Indiana Supreme Court suspended their chief deputy prosecutor for LaPorte County, at least for a minimum of 4 years, with no automatic reinstatement, because he was eavesdropping on an attorney-client conversation.
That's at least something that's like obvious. That's something that non-prosecutors have the opportunity to do and should lose their licenses for. I can't believe you would intentionally do that. See, I have to like, most of us in our jobs have to, in certain situations, take a lot of active care to make sure we don't hear that stuff and guard ourselves from hearing it. I can't believe you would seek it out. That's incredibly stupid. Not to mention, you know, immoral and unethical.
And right. Wrong. Something a human wouldn't
yeah,
do.
Yeah, something, well, I'm just saying even your self-interest should have prevented that, but I guess not.
Judge Block's third idea would be, and this is the one I really, really like, and I'm going to quote here, prosecutors who intentionally withhold exculpatory evidence resulting in a wrongful conviction should be prosecuted for obstruction of justice. The good ones need not be concerned, but the bad, quote-unquote, deplorable ones should know that there might be civil and criminal consequences for misconduct.
It's a really good idea.
I'd go even a little bit farther in that I'm like, again, like the Juan Rivera prosecutor, it's like, okay, so you knew the DNA didn't indict him? So you allowed the DNA to be added, but then you actively sought to overwrite it and then used your closing statement to say, pay no attention to the DNA. This poor man was tortured into falsely confessing, and that's why you should convict him. You need to go to prison. again, Juan Rivera should own any knickknacks that you own, and you should be languishing in a prison for as long as that happened. I have nothing to say that won't break the no swearing rule. Before we get on to something specific with plea bargaining, do you have any other general thoughts about prosecutor immunity, prosecutor culture?
I'm glad to hear the extreme pro-defense, hold government entities and individuals accountable position coming from someone besides me. I feel like I'm alone in that sometimes. I had never thought of prosecuting prosecutors for obstruction of justice. That is genius. And someone should elect this man to a political position immediately.
There are a lot of things we could talk about with prosecutors specifically, but the thing I want to talk about the most is plea bargaining, because I think it's the most emblematic of things wrong with the prosecutorial system, in my opinion. And it's also the one I've received the most flack for not liking from my friends who are prosecutors, even some of my friends who aren't really in the legal system. But once I explain what plea bargaining is, I always get some variety of the same argument. I'd like to preface with this, because then I'm going to explain what this is. And if you think this is a valid argument after understanding how plea bargaining works, I don't know what to tell you, because no swearing rule. But I'm given some variety of the argument that, well, how could they do their jobs without plea bargaining? They need it to do their jobs. Can you imagine how hard they'd have to work? And I'm like, if I didn't read any of my students' essays, and my excuse was, well, I teach between 30 to 50 students a semester. That's a lot of essays. Do you know how hard it is to do research and teach if I have to read three-page essays from 45 students? So I'm just going to see if they filled out three pages or not. And if they didn't, you know, I'm just going to see what my general thought is after skimming it and give them an A or an F. That's the option. They either completely pass, they completely fail based on the 30 seconds I skim their paper. I'd get fired. And I should be. But prosecutors, these so-called gods among men, apparently get a pass for some effing reason. So, plea bargaining. Let's talk about the research, then we'll go into the stuff, and I'm sure you have thoughts about this.
Oh, I have tons. I'm just going to sit here and wait for you to get through the research, because I have thoughts just on what little's been said so far.
Okay, well, first of all, plea bargaining for me falls under, actually in the scientific literature, it does the same thing. It's very similar to coerced false confessions. It falls under that same category of, we're not touching you, so technically this isn't torture. Between 18 to 22% of exonerations involve a plea bargain. That means between 18 to 22% of people who were not guilty pled guilty because they were scared of the prosecutor. Those are worse odds than Russian roulette. I would, looking at, let's just assume that the exonerations represent how many people are actually wrongfully incarcerated, which is, by the way, a terrible assumption. Way more people are wrongfully incarcerated than who can actually be exonerated because our criminal justice system is a hellhole. But let's just put that aside for a second. It is genuinely safer to take a 5-shot, not even a 6-shot, a 5-shot revolver. You will have better odds of surviving playing Russian roulette with a 5-shot revolver than you will getting through a trial scenario without being pressured into pleading guilty, even if you're an innocent person. So there you go with that. Plea bargaining has not been quite as in-depth studied as false confessions have, but it's been pretty nicely studied. 90 to 95% of convictions are via guilty plea. The Supreme Court has remarked on this. And so Drs. Henderson and Levitt wanted to go in and say, okay, well, how can we, if we get somebody to cheat on a small task, right? You take them into the study and you say, hey, don't look at the answers. We need you to figure out these word problems. Somebody offers to cheat, they accept the help. That's the quote unquote crime here, right? At least in terms of ethical research, that's as good as you can get, especially considering cheating. If you put it in the realms of, hey, you cheated. Now, I know this is a study, but that's still cheating. It's against the honor code. We may suspend you. Of the people who cheated, they get given an advocate, i.e. an attorney, and they're given the chance to go to a full hearing or to take a plea bargain. Now, if your advocate, i.e. your defense attorney, says, yeah, go to the full hearing, you're innocent, we know you're innocent. The innocent people who didn't cheat but who were accused of cheating, they wouldn't go to trial. I think it was like 4%. Yeah, 4% of them took a plea bargain. They'd go to trial instead if their advocate said that they should. But if their advocate didn't say that they should, you're looking at around 50 and sometimes well over 50% of participants taking a plea bargain, saying they cheated when they know from the camera that they didn't. And then saying, I'd rather take the lesser consequences, because that's what a plea bargain is. A plea bargain is just saying, hey, I don't want to go through honoring your rights under the Constitution to a trial by a jury of your peers. So how about you just agree that you're guilty and we give you an easier sentence? And empirically, you know, I mentioned Henderson and Levitt. We found tons of other studies that show the same thing. Unless you have a qualified attorney who you trust saying, are you insane? Go to court. Innocent people will take a plea bargain. They would rather plead guilty. And there's a ton of reasons why for that. But before we get into those, because I'm going to take a quick scotch break. Do you have any thoughts, Austin, so I don't break the no swearing rule?
I will say for one thing really quickly, defense attorneys often aren't going to make that recommendation, though I have to say there's a problem with defense attorneys. And it's not really our fault. It's kind of, you know, a good thing if you want to look at it this way. We mostly defend guilty people. I know we're talking about the innocent defendant, and I think we should still be talking about the innocent defendant because that's who the system is really meant to protect. But to understand why defense attorneys do what they do and how they work, they spend most of their time defending people who are guilty. A lot of the actual day-to-day work of trying to achieve justice that a defense attorney does is trying to make sure that their guilty client gets a proportionate and fair punishment instead of having the book thrown at them. So the problem that you run into is that when you have an actually innocent defendant, a lot of defense attorneys don't actually know how to properly represent an innocent defendant because they never have any. And the reason I say this is a good thing is that at least, you know, the vast majority of people who are accused of crimes actually did them. Okay, well, the police and prosecutors have, you know, a success rate of a sort there. For clarity, I still maintain that the atrocious, terrible things that happen to innocent defendants mean more than just the ratios and the success rate. The 0.01% or whatever it is, whatever your tiny percentages of defendants who are innocent who still suffer is a bigger problem than anything else, no matter how small of a problem it is in terms of numbers of people. That said, you might be thinking, oh, well, you know, a competent defense attorney is always going to tell their innocent client to go to trial. Not true, unfortunately, because a lot of defense attorneys aren't actually going to believe that their client's innocent because, you know, the last 10 guys I dealt with that week who said they didn't do it obviously did it. So, you know, they lie all the time. I'm sorry, criminals are liars. So how does the defense attorney in most cases really tell if the person they have is innocent and telling the truth and has been falsely accused, or if it's just another criminal who will say anything to try and get out of something? That's, to me, just a realist observation that has to be made. That's actually a problem that if you're a self-defense and or firearms person, one of the biggest pieces of advice that experts like Masad Ayoub will give, if you're a person who's lawfully defended themselves and is facing prosecution, the first thing you should ask your attorney is what their opinion is in going to trial. And if their opinion is, I never go to trial, or I was charged with plea bargain, take a plea bargain, or if you ask, what do you think about putting your defendant on the stand? And their response is, I never put my defendant on the stand. Get a different attorney. This attorney only knows how to represent guilty people. So that's a real problem. So just to put those stats in perspective of, only 4% don't go to trial if they have their attorney telling them not to. That isn't actually going to help as much as you might think it does in the real world. And again, that's not, I don't think, really defense attorneys' faults. The other thing I would say is that because they're accustomed to dealing with the guilty defendant or even an innocent defendant who's facing a hard trial, defense attorneys can't always say, oh yeah, let's just go to trial. Whether or not you go to trial is one of the three things that a criminal defendant has absolute control over and can veto their attorney. The other one is whether or not they take the stand, and the other one is whether or not they demand a jury trial. Those are three things that are inviolate rights that the defendant gets to make in regards to how their counsel represents them. Counsel can advise, but they cannot make decisions. Flip side is everything else in a criminal defense case, your attorney can actually make the decisions, the ultimate decision after consulting you on it. But in advising clients regarding whether or not to go to trial, you have to play this game, and I guess we're going to talk about why this is a terrible game. You've got to play the game of, well, what happens if you go to trial and you're convicted? Especially when you have a felony charge and a misdemeanor plea deal offered, 99 times out of 100, you're going to take that, because avoiding a felony conviction, taking a misdemeanor instead, is normally considered a huge win. That is like, we're done. We're taking that. Why would we talk about anything else? So what I'm saying is, don't be hard on defense attorneys when you find that they aren't always telling their clients to go to trial, because there's a lot of factors to consider. An expense of trial is included. The emotional and mental burden of going through trial is included. There's a lot that goes into it. And in some cases, you know, plea bargains aren't all bad. Sometimes they're the right thing. Sometimes they're good for the defendant. Of course, that's only true of guilty defendants. So with all that said, let's get back to talking about how the system works for the innocent person, who, as rare as they might be, is far more important than any of the rest of the defendants we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think it's good that you bring up that defense attorneys aren't really to blame here, especially because I don't think you mentioned this, but some of these attorneys aren't. I mean, you mentioned this the last episode. It could be someone like you. Like, if I don't have the money for an attorney and I'm in Iowa and it's not literally me because I don't get to say, yes, please, please have my freshman roommate represent me in court. And they get someone who's not a full-time criminal lawyer, that person may just be like, this seems like a good plea bargain and you should take it. They're not – this isn't what they signed up for.
Yeah. Another factor of that is your attorney confident in their own ability to conduct a trial? And with how rare trials are, that correlates directly to how rare trial experience is for attorneys.
Yeah, and again, when 95% – I'm going to read actually from a Supreme Court case. This is Lafler versus Cooper. Criminal justice today is for the most part a system of pleas, not a system of trials. Page 1388 of Lafler versus Cooper, 2012. Yeah, most attorneys in the criminal justice part of this don't go to trial. Prosecutors have a ton of experience. Defense attorneys, perhaps not so much. They're often underpaid and overworked. And the thing is, like, yes, a lot of the people who are given plea bargains, they are guilty. And that's the thing that I think makes this so insidious, is that, yeah, the idea is, well, it works right most of the time. It's just the times it doesn't work that it goes disastrously wrong. But because that's only the most 1% to 2% of trials, let's say, that's a relatively generous estimate. We don't think we should care about that, except for the fact that that 1% to 2% completely invalidates and undermines the criminal justice system itself. And I think it's also worth pointing out, a lot of these so-called criminals are only criminals because we have an over-criminalization problem.
That's the other thing that's going to factor into prosecutors saying, oh, well, if you don't let me do this, I can't do my job. Okay, well, let's end the drug war and reduce your caseload.
Yeah, and so for me, I have this fundamental problem with plea bargaining, because it's like, I'm sorry, you have a right to a trial by jury, and prosecutors should not be doing this. It's great when it works for guilty people. Sure, I'll grant that. The problem is it is so incredibly friggin' coercive that no innocent person can emerge from this without terrible consequences.
And I'll say, just to tie in the last episode, this is where my thing about the state should pay your attorney's fees if you go to trial and win. It would make a real difference here. I'm not just talking about punishing the state for prosecuting innocent people when it shouldn't have. I'm talking about whether or not you go to trial should be a real choice. And that would be another factor in favor of going to trial. You still have other problems you need to fix, but at least address one factor.
Well, yeah, because that's the thing is plea bargaining is convenient. The fact is prosecutors have too much power. And instead of using a plea bargain to get rid of cases they know they could win and just get them done more quickly, they are instead used for cases that they don't want to go to trial, because they know if they go to trial, they'll lose. But there's all sorts of incentives in a plea bargaining situation that really become a danger to an innocent individual. For starters, there's so much pressure on it. So we're going to start with the assumption that the person under question here, the defendant, is an innocent person. Well, first off, you're given the plea bargain. The entire idea is you say that you're guilty and you get a lesser sentence. Originally, it was just to incentivize you to take the guilty plea, which is its own problem. But now it's started to come out that this isn't just about incentives. It's about personal vengeance for disrespecting the prosecutor by not taking his mercy. The idea is, either you take my plea bargain or I will try to get everything that the law can do to you done to you. I will make your life miserable, or you take my plea bargain. Now, this doesn't mean that for all cases they're trying to get you executed, but like you even mentioned, it might be like, okay, I'm innocent of the misdemeanor. I haven't done anything wrong, but if I take the guilty plea, I have a misdemeanor and thus no permanent record. If I go to court, the prosecutor promises he'll get me convicted on a felony plea. Do I want to risk that? Do I want to risk becoming a felon for the rest of my life? Or would I rather just take the easy out here? It's such a coercive situation. Like, again, it's the power of the situation.
Right. This isn't the system you would have if your true goal, if what you really cared about was determining guilt and innocence. Because you've created an incentive structure where innocent people are going to take a deal and plead guilty.
And here's the other thing. Because you mentioned bail and bond and stuff like that earlier in this episode. If somebody can make bail or make bond and get out of prison, they're actually better at jail, I should say. They're not in prison yet. But they're actually better at making decisions. Not good, just better. For plea bargaining, because what they consider to be the baseline, they're like, okay, I either give up my freedom or I go to prison. But a lot of people can't make bail, or sometimes they aren't even given a bail option. And then their decision making sucks because they're in jail and that's now their new baseline. They're like, oh God, I'm going to stay here forever. I am never going to get out. Or it becomes, I could get out now. You know, I could get out in like 6 months, or I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. So it's such a coercive situation.
That is a real thing. That is a absolutely real thing that I see in my job, is people will make the decision that in the short term gets them out and back to their lives, even if it long term means, well, you pled to this thing, it's going to put you back in for X amount of time. People absolutely make that short term oriented decision. And it's not, you can tell objectively it's not good decision making, but you can't do a ton about it, because all you can really do is give your client the options and see what they do after you tell them everything about the alternatives.
It's the same thing as a coerced false confession. A lot of innocent people think, oh yeah, if I just confess, they'll know it's not me, because they'll definitely not just assume I'm guilty and stop pursuing evidence. But for the moment, I'll be out of jail and I won't be being interrogated. People suck at long-term decision-making. To go into some of even the more bigger problems with this is, you know, I've talked about the fundamental attribution error before, but it's one of those other things. We discount the power of coercive situations when we judge other people's behavior. We just do, unfortunately. And there's just so much coercive power in these situations. For starters, the prosecutor has the power of a god and presents him or herself as such. You have no choice but to take this. They have all the power in the situation. And as you mentioned and I mentioned, even if you have counsel, the counsel recognizes this and is probably going to be in line with that assumption. Yeah, the prosecutor has all the power in this situation. You've been arrested and you're being charged. There's a lot of other things. You know, you learn some version of this, whether you take basic psychology or at least social psychology or marketing, except the difference is in social psychology, at least if you're taking it with me, I put it in more of terms of used car salesman coercing you into buying a bad car. And marketing, this is called an important life skill. But scarcity and reciprocity and fear are three things all present. They're very powerful motivators to decision making. They're bad things to make a decision out of, but they're all present in the plea bargain. So scarcity. Prosecutors will say things like, okay, I'll give you the easier bargain, but you say yes to this now or it's away forever. And a lot of prosecutors, they are intentionally giving you that before you have time to really sit, think, and confer with your counsel. They want you to make the decision immediately so you can be something they check off their docket. You might have a great potential to make it out of court, you know, because the prosecutor, if he's offering you a plea deal, here's the thing. They already don't necessarily think they can win. There is at least some doubt of it, at least potentially.
It's that, or it's such a minor crime, they don't feel like devoting the resources to it.
Yeah, well, then let's say it's a major crime. They're offering you a plea bargain. They're not confident about their ability to win in a full jury trial. So to compensate for this, they're going to be bullies. So they don't want you realizing that if this goes to a jury trial, you might win. So they're going to threaten you. And unfortunately, they have the power to do this. It's where it's like, I give you a relatively nice plea deal, but if you go to the jury trial and I happen to win, very bad things happen to you. you want to think, let's put this in terms, by the way, scarcity and all that stuff. Let's put this in non-legal terms, and I think that'll actually drive this home more. We've all bought electronics, and we've been offered a protection plan, whether it's at Radio Shack, assuming there's such a thing as Radio Shack anymore. There may not be. I haven't been to a mall in a long time. Or it's on Amazon. Regardless, you have that little protection plan, and it's like, okay, I'll lose money, but if the worst should happen, at least I'm protected. We like avoiding in our decision making. We do not want the idea to be there that the worst could happen. So in terms of the criminal trial, it may be that if this goes to trial, there's no way in hell you get convicted. No jury in the world would rationally decide against you. But the prosecutor who's looking at you is going, there's a chance you lose. And if you lose, I'm going to make your life an absolute misery. You'd rather take the safe loss than the risky gain. It's just a flaw with decision making, and it's very counterintuitive because a lot of people think that they'd take risks and then they get into the situation and they don't. Another social force working on people is reciprocity. Again, somebody does something nice for you, you want to do something nice for them. The prosecutor says, I've worked very hard to get you this deal, so why don't you do me a solid and take the deal? But you feel that obligation to them. It's like, well, they were so nice to me. I should do this. And that sounds ridiculous until you're in the situation. I mean, we've all been there with things like buying a car and stuff, right? Like, objectively, you're the customer and you're always right. But even if they say little things like, oh, I've really worked hard to get you this price, you feel like a jerk even if it's not a price that you want to pay. Same decision-making flaw applies in terms of plea bargaining. And then the third big one is just sheer freaking fear. Like, I don't want to go to prison. I'm scared of going to prison. If I take this plea bargain, I avoid prison, or I at least avoid as much prison. Fear is a terrible, terrible motivator for decision-making. But it's something that prosecutors wield against you like a club. And once again, like, plea bargaining is a prosecutor deciding they don't want to do their job. And it is related to other issues like overcriminalization and all that stuff. And maybe they're right. You know, maybe they're right. Even if I grant them that they're right and they couldn't be able to do their job without plea bargaining, then their job shouldn't freaking exist.
That's my point, is the system needs to change. I actually agree. If prosecutors didn't use plea bargaining the way that they do, they would not be able to handle their current caseload. The problem is the caseload, not what they're doing to solve it is the problem. You know what I mean? The problem is the caseload. We should quit trying to find solutions and let them manage that caseload and figure out, why do we have so many criminal defendants in this country? You know, related question, why have we imprisoned such an astronomically high percentage of our population compared to other countries? Maybe we should do something about this. And I'm going to keep coming back to one of the big ones is ending the drug war. And I'm not saying make all of America into one giant heroin den. I'm saying put that money into treatment instead. But as far as prosecutors' offices go, man, they would have a much lighter caseload if they didn't have substance-related violations. I would throw into that not prosecuting underage use of alcohol, not prosecuting anything related to tobacco. This just isn't worth it, especially with the way you know, say you're going to save people from ruining their lives by using drugs, and then you ruin their lives with criminal convictions. That's a big one for me. Take all of the victimless crimes off the caseload, off the docket, and let's have real criminal justice for all the other ones.
The word systemic or systematic seems to set off a certain segment of the population. What I'm going to call the PragerU segment of the population, because you know what? I don't like PragerU. I'm just going to say it. And everything they've done with criminal justice over the last month, where they think they're quote unquote owning the libs, just to me, I'm like, if this were a project and you handed it in to me, I have never given an F before, but you'd get one from me. So congratulations. The entire idea is like, well, there's no such thing as a systematic problem in the criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system works great. There is nothing systematic because, you know, we're an individualist society, blah, blah, blah. And to me, I'm like, this is a systemic problem. It is absolutely a systemic and systematic problem, because I've been getting angry at prosecutors this whole time, partially because it's a fun shtick. But I do genuinely believe some of these people who become prosecutors, and I think you see, I think, by the way, as evidence of this opinion, this is why so many people don't stay prosecutors. It's because it's a system that chews you up and spits you out unless you become a raging psychopath.
Yeah, I could be a prosecutor if it was a different system, because obviously there are some things I think should definitely be illegal. It's something I could do, and I think I'd be decent at. I would never in a million years consider it in its current form as a career path for me. I wouldn't last a year.
Yeah, no one can go into this and keep their soul alive. That's my thing. Is it's like the system itself is self-perpetuating at this point. So people can go in to be prosecutors and they want to see justice. They have all these ideals and they're going to emerge psychopaths who wield plea bargains like clubs and are willing to do whatever they can to get a conviction. Or they're going to stop being a prosecutor, which is where I think most of them end up. They do their time, they get hired at a private firm, and they never want to think about it again, which to me indicates the problem isn't with the people who – I mean, there's a problem with the people who choose to stay into this bad system, sure, but that's not the primary problem. The primary problem is the system itself. And, you know, to me, obviously I'm pro-police reform. I'm obviously pro-police reform. I really hope that's not up for debate at this point. But in a lot of ways, I think prosecutor reform is more important because it's the prosecutors who are ending lives in a very real way here. The cops, okay, yes, they sometimes end lives literally because they murder people. But look at how many people we incarcerate and how many people we give felony records to.
Yeah, I would say that as big an issue as it is, this affects more people.
So if we want to see criminal justice reform... Yeah, I think we have to look at prosecutors. I think we just absolutely have to. So, any final thoughts on prosecutors, prosecutorial indiscretion, what have you?
I thought we were calling it prosecutorial indiscretion. It's a good term. No, I still think that there's some ways to fix it, but they're very radical. Both this and police brutality absolutely require ending the drug war as a way to fix it. I know that conservatives are going to hate that, and I know that a lot of people who are earnestly striving for these reforms aren't going to want to go that far or aren't going to consider that a realistic option, but I don't see a way that any of this gets fixed without that being part of the solution. It is not a fix-all. It is not the one and only solution, but it's crucial. It's required, which is why, in the end, I'm pretty pessimistic about getting any of this fixed because I don't see this country ending its drug war anytime soon. It's been going 50 years strong. Why stop now? We're winning, I think, apparently, right? Drugs are losing, right?
The war on drugs has been lost to a plant. I'm sorry. Everyone consistently goes back to the most embarrassing war loss being the Great Emu War. Just all I'm going to say is I have seen marijuana plants and I have seen emus. I have more respect for the Australian military losing a war to bushes on legs with giant claws than I do the superpower and back-to-back World War champs losing to a friggin' leaf. But there you go. But yeah, no, as far as the war on drugs goes, I think you're right. It has to stop. The war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on truancy. I am so sick to friggin' death of war on abstract concepts. And I think one of the biggest problems is trying to get the war on drugs finished or to see criminal justice reform. And maybe this is just because I do live in the South. I live in the Bible Belt. I mean, for crying out loud, being able to buy beer cold is still a novelty to me down here. But you talk to people about this stuff, and it always comes back to emotion. It always comes back to, you know, well, but drugs tear apart families or some version of that. I honestly want to tell more of them, like, you know, I'm like, here's a list of every pothead you know. You don't think you know them. You think that they would never do weed, but here you go. Here are the people you are willing to see sent to prison over this. And with this issue of prosecutorial discretion, that's why I think this is where we really have to – I think that the fight against it has to involve emotion. I'm not a huge fan of emotion, but we do have to – it's not just think about what would happen if you were involved. It's look at the actual families who are torn apart by this crap. Look at the actual human beings whose lives are ravaged because our criminal justice system is more concerned with getting people in prison because we have way too many laws than it is with actually keeping us safe. And that's why I think that these efforts have to involve cases like Juan Rivera. They have to involve podcasts like Dateline or Serial, where we look at wrongful convictions and we look at the criminal justice system and all of its ugliness. And I mean, for one of the things that got me so fired up about this to the point that I wanted to work in the field and commit myself to almost every research article I read depressing me is because I got to see names attached to faces. And, you know, we've seen that happen with police brutality. We you know, this past week with people are outraged at the sheer lack of care with the justice for Breonna Taylor. But we have names like Breonna Taylor. We have names like George Floyd for police brutality. I think we need them for prosecutorial discretion and prosecutorial misconduct. And we need to see that real people get hurt by this. I have no happy way to take this episode out because, as I said, this is the one that makes me want to break the no swearing rule because it's so in-depth and I can't see a clear fix that I'm not sure you could actually even get people passionate about this because I think it would just depress them. And by the end of the time, like, people would just give up because there's no clear path to victory. And also, I'm not stupid enough to ask you to try to bring us out on a happy note of anything.
Oh, we learned something then. Learning occurred.
Well, guys, if you have any specific questions or comments, we've actually gotten a couple for the last couple of episodes we did, but not quite enough to do a full segment. If we don't get any more, we'll bring those up at the beginning of the next episode. But if you have anything specifically about prosecutorial discretion or indiscretion or plea bargaining or something you don't think we brought up that you'd like to hear our thoughts on, do reach out to us at facebook.com/libertysnark. Send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. We'll be back next week. Take care, guys. This has been Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a share on social media or leaving us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at facebook.com/libertysnark or send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening.